This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
You don't want to do our pre-show Batman banter?
Oh, we can.
I guess we're talking, you know, just talking about the history of stuff.
Yeah.
From the, you know, we're talking Batman, but we're talking about like comics from the late 60s, 70s, and earlier stuff, and Comics Code Authority coming in and messing up stuff and everything.
Yeah, and I can talk Batman all night. But
yeah, I know. But we're supposed to be talking about independent comics.
That's true.
But it is influenced by, you know, the mainstream stuff. I don't know. There was a bunch of I've been doing a lot of, like, history into the comics and everything, and it was almost like the Comics Code Authority was a self-fulfilling prophecy for some aspects, because I was reading the paper where, because before the code, I mean, you had EC and all the Westerns and all the other violent and the comics and the horror and everything, so they really weren't kids' comics until the Comics Code Authority came in. And they had to make the comics for the kids to read because they said comics were corrupting the kids. And, you know, they came and said, oh, it's all wholesome and everything now. Look at it. And then so now you've had the stereotype since, what was that, the late 50s?
Yeah.
The Comics Code Authority. So up until I think probably maybe the 80s is when they started branching, you know, trying to get out of it. And they really didn't get the Comics Code Authority off comics till what, the mid 2000s or the early 2000s?
Yeah, I think there were still comics that kept the little symbol, the Comics Code, approved by the Comics Code Authority up until early 2000s.
Yeah, but everybody thought they were for kids.
I know.
And so it kind of just fulfilled it when they kind of like neutered comics with the Comic Code Authority and made them more for kids. And then it's like, see, they're for kids now. And it just perpetuated and, you know, I think that's why a lot of the Golden Age and the everything pre-code has kind of like gone up in value over the past several years because everybody's, you know, realized, and maybe some before, you know, for decades now, that, you know, that's what comics originally were. They were more for adults, not for kids.
Yeah.
And
I can't remember the exact issue, but I mean, it didn't take long early on in Detective Comics for Batman to carry a pistol and actually end up killing people. You know, there's a stereotype, Batman does not kill. Well, wrong. You haven't read the comics closely enough. If you're interested in history, there's a book I would recommend. It's called The 10-Cent Plague. And it's really that whole history of that era and how the Comics Code came into play. And this Frederick Wortham, who wrote the book, that this incendiary book that kind of started everybody's...
Oh, The Seduction of the Innocent?
Yeah, Seduction of the Innocent was his book, and this book, they kind of go into that book, but all other aspects, and it's a really well-written book. I'm really interested in the history of, like I said, the Golden Age.
Hey, did I send you some links to those papers I was reading on the history and the business of comics? And what was interesting was the only comic publisher that ended up getting away from the CCA, and I didn't realize that until I read it in the paper and then I looked, was Dell. Dell never put a CCA logo on the front of their books because they were doing the Westerns and the TV shows and everything, so they were already considered wholesome and good for kids.
Right.
So they never had to comply, and they were the market leader up until the superheroes got reintroduced in the early 60s. I think when Marvel, you know, the kickoff of the Silver Age was Showcase 4 and then into the Marvel Silver Age, Dell was doing better than DC and Atlas timely that came Marvel.
Right.
And then they just, I guess, they had the licenses and all that, and I guess that was the crack in their armor, was they had these licenses and those didn't translate over well, or I think they got broken up into Western or Whitman and Dell, and then by that time they couldn't create their own characters that would that took, and DC and Marvel overtook them through the 60s, and then they just kind of faded into obscurity. But I tell you what, early Dells are highly collectible.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of those, because, you know, we think about the big two. Well, there really wasn't a big two until kind of early 60s before.
Nope.
When DC and Marvel started separating from themselves. But yeah, the popularity, especially in the Golden Age, after 37 and 38, when Superman and Batman, you know, and those comics were selling 15 million a month. Everybody was in the comics business. Dell, Phantom, exactly. Doubleday, Fawcett. I mean, if you were a publisher, you had a printing press, you were printing comics. And
the reason there's not so many of them around is like a lot of that came along when there was like the World War II and there was the paper recycling.
Right.
And other, and you know, comics weren't collectibles. They were pulps.
Yeah, they were like throwaway.
You know, just roll them up, throw them in your back pocket, put them in the spokes of your bicycle, whatever.
I read something, some figure somewhere that back in that era, especially the early Golden Age, that a comic book generally, they said that changed hands 5 to 6 times. So people would pass it on. A kid would read it and they would trade it to his friend for something else. And then he'd loan it to somebody else, and so it just got passed along, and they eventually disappeared or got recycled, whatever. But like I said, nobody was thinking about collectability.
Well, I know that's what's so amazing, though, when you see some of these books from the 40s, well, maybe late 40s, 50s, into 60s. I mean, you know, we were talking last weekend, you know, with Martin and them. You know, he was on eBay and all that, and we were starting to go to Heritage and these other auction sites, and you can find high grade copies of books from the 50s and the 60s, and you're just wondering, how the hell did these remain in such great condition?
It is amazing. I mean, you would see something like a book from the 40s that's a 7.5 or something, and you think, well, that 7.5 is not that great. No, you're thinking with current mentality, you know, about the 9.8, but a 7.5 of cheap, very cheapest pulp paper to last from the 40s into the 2000s and still be a 7.5, that's astounding. I mean,
it's 70 years.
Yeah.
So
a lot of people don't think of that mentality.
Well, have you ever heard the story about the Mile High collection? I mean, what the collection was that started Mile High Comics in Denver?
Yeah,
where
it's been a long time since I've revisited it, but I remember.
Well, I mean, basically, what it was this individual had been gathering comics and magazines and all the other stuff to get art and other items out of it. So he would just buy everything, and he was using it for reference. So he'd buy it and just stick it in there, and some of it he went through, and some of it he didn't. And when he died, his family, actually they carried a bunch of stuff to the dump, like the early Disney and other stuff like that. And only when they got to the comic stuff, they kind of asked, and I, you know, Justin would know probably more about it than anything. But yeah, he got called there to look at it, and it was this basement or room or level of a house, and it was just all these comics from the gold, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and the guy just accumulated it because he wanted it for reference.
That's astounding.
And he just bought it, and he just stuck it on the shelf, and some of it he may have opened, so a lot of it was in pristine condition. And I think I want to remember reading a story about some EC stuff. There was one of the workers at EC or one of the editors or something. Every book of EC that came out, he took 10 copies off fresh off the press, wrapped them up in brown wrapping paper and put them in his closet. And they sat there for 30 or 40 years. And he finally, you know, then he just opened them up 40 years later on all the EC stuff of every issue.
Yeah, that's some amazing stories on that.
So, but yeah, but no, but there was no intention of them being collectibles or anything. It was what they were into, and you know, they just kind of stored it away and forgot about it, and then decades later, hey, something valuable. Don't we all wish we could have done that? Like, back in the late 70s, don't I wish I could have, like, talked to my parents to buy me all those Star Wars figures, and I should have not opened any of them and just stuck them somewhere and brought them out?
Well, I think, I'm not certain that they were first editions, but they may have been. When I was a young kid, you know, my mother bought me a lot of the Dr. Seuss books, Green Eggs and Ham, and all the others. Some of those might have been, if not first edition, very early editions, that would probably be worth something today, but she got rid of them all. It's like,
well, I like to frequent used bookstores because I can find,
oh, I do too.
Find, you know, I look for comics and I look for other stuff. And it's amazing now you go and you look in the section where they've got the rare and the valuable books and you'll see first editions of Harry Potter for hundreds of dollars or first editions of the Hunger Games books for hundreds of dollars. And so a lot of the young adult and the very popular books that have made, you know, film franchises and all that, mm-hmm. first editions of those are very expensive. And I tell you what, my dream would be if I ever hit the lottery and all that, one of the first things I'm going to go out and buy is I'm going to buy, try to find first editions of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. British editions.
Right. Those would be nice from a collectible standpoint, not from a reading standpoint.
It depends on the condition.
That's true. That is true.
I mean, and that's like one area where my wife and I share interest because she does not do comics or anything like that, but she can understand my collecting habit because she collects first edition children's books that deal with horses. So like Black Beauty,
right,
and other books like that. So it's a very specific genre, but that's what she likes to do. First edition children's books with the theme of horses. Where that came from, I have no idea, but to each their own. So I don't guess we're talking too much about independent comics tonight, but you know, I think it's still an interesting discussion on everything like that. So, well, you know, when we originally conceived of Best of the Rest, we were going to do current and past issues. And I think we've been kind of a rut lately of what we've recently read and things we've done. And, you know, we haven't delved back into our past of what, you know, got us into independent comics and what we enjoyed back in the day. Maybe we don't enjoy it now, or but kind of going into it. But I think, you know, your big love is Love and Rockets, and we've talked a lot about that. And I think for me, it kind of, I've talked quite a bit on like Poison Elves and things like that. And so we probably need to mix it up a bit.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I've talked a lot about Love and Rockets, but I don't know if I've told the story about how I discovered it, because they started back in 19... Well, it was... They published the Gilbert, Jaime, and Mario self-published the first issue of Love and Rockets in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just on paper and put a $1 cover price on it and started hawking it to conventions. And a copy of that found its way to the publisher of Fantagraphics, which was a fairly small, still small publisher, had been around for 5-6 years. And so they re-released it in 82, starting in 82. The two things that made it pretty unique were it was published in magazine size format, not the standard comic book format. It really was one of the first, two of the two titles that are really considered to be the first real big breakout independent comics from the previous underground comics are ElfQuest and Love and Rockets. I've not read much.
You wouldn't throw the TMNT in there?
Yeah, that was an early one, but that was a little bit later than those two.
Oh, I thought ElfQuest was like in late 70s.
Well, that may have been.
For some reason, I want to think like the ElfQuest was like the original. If you're not talking like your underground comics from like Crumb.
No, I'm not talking about those. Yeah. Although those are certainly independent comics, but they're a little bit
What about the early heavy metal stuff? It kind of gets a little blurry the further back you get.
It does. I mean, I don't think there's any hard date when you can say independent comics, because there's always been something. You know, the underground comics were, they were from small presses, small publishers, so they were certainly fit all the parameters of independent comics. You can even go back into the 30s when they did the... Have you ever heard of the Tijuana Bibles? Is that a...
What is that?
They were generally... During the popularity of the Golden Age of the superheroes, people started publishing these stories that were essentially, they would take the superheroes, the main favorite characters, and write pornographic stories about them, of the in sexual encounters. they were small sized comic books, and they were, you know, passed around kind of underground black market, but they became very popular. If you remember in Watchmen, there was a scene there where Laurie, who's the second Silk Spectre, goes to visit her mother, Sally Jupiter.
Yes.
And she pulls out and says, "Hey, somebody sent me this. An old fan of mine sent me this." And it was a Tijuana Bible. And Laurie flips through it, and she's disgusted by it. Says, "Mother, how can you keep this?" And Sally's kind of flattered by the whole thing.
No, I remember that scene in there, but I had never associated it with that.
But yeah, that was a reference to those pornographic takeoffs on superheroes that were popular, you know, the 30s into the 40s, I think. I guess all that is to say that this whole underground or alternative comics has really been a kind of around since, in some kind of a form, since the very beginning.
Okay, so there were independent comics. Well, actually, you know, maybe this helps us dive into the independent comics kind of thing. So back in the 40s and the 50s, would like Carlton Comics and Fawcett, all of them been counted as independents? I mean, I think some of them were bigger than the DCs at the time. And at the time, there was no Marvel. There was like, what was it, Timely or Atlas?
Right.
But
that's what given some thought to, and I don't know if you could say that there was such thing as independent comics, or it was all independent comics.
I mean, do you throw the pulps in there?
You could.
The crime noir pulps and everything?
You could. I don't know. It's interesting intellectual discussion about when exactly did, quote-unquote, independent comics or alternative comics begin.
Because I guess that's interesting, because I guess sometimes you see the Platinum Age, you know, which predated the Golden Age, which were just reprints of, like, comic strips and everything. You know, they say the first comic was, what was it? I forget what it is, but it was a comic strip from a newspaper and everything.
Well, it wasn't
a true serial.
Yeah, one of the first comic books collection was called Famous Funnies.
That's it.
Well, they were just, reprints of daily strips that came out of the newspapers. And those are really considered the first proto comics or pre comic books in the, you know, those in the early 30s. But then National Allied Publishing, which became DC, they started hiring. They were kind of starting to run out of reprints of old strips. Plus, they were having problems getting syndication or licensing, so they started hiring a bunch of kids, you know, unknowns, to write original strips. But it was still, you know, three or four panel strips and not serialized sequential art. And they published it under a title called New Fun. And
yes,
it was all original material, you know, like sort of, and then it started transitioning into longer stories. And, you know, the early comic books, like Detective Comics, were really, those were all 64 pages. And it wasn't just one story. It was an anthology of, you know, a collection of several stories. You know, Detective Comics, Batman was not the only story in Detective Comics 27, but it's the one.
Yeah, and there were 26 issues before there was Batman.
Yeah.
Now, I guess the thing is, DC actually Detective Comics?
DC.
That's what DC stands for.
I think so. So yeah, it's kind of redundant. If you say DC Comics, you're saying Detective Comics Comics. This is the official name. I think it's just they took the initials, but it's, I don't think it actually stands for Detective Comics, but it's, it does. But, I mean, it's obvious where they got it.
Is it? Or is it? I'm trying to remember.
What else?
Does DC, oh, distributed comics, just, you know.
Oh, the original name was National Allied Publishing, I believe.
Oh, well, that's something we can figure out offline for everybody.
National Allied Publications.
Ah. And then somehow it became DC. When did it become DC? So, actually, let me ask you this. If you got a Detective Comics 27 or an Action Comics number 1 or a Superman number 1 or a Batman number 1, would it say DC Comics on it? And, I mean, at that time, they were probably what we would file under independent comics that we do now. Just one of several trying to gain market share, trying to gain space on the rack because they were all sold in newsstands. There were no direct marketing. I actually didn't realize that until I was reading about the direct marketing didn't really come about until, I think, the early 80s.
Right.
Is that correct? So you didn't have comic shops then. Everything was put on the newsstand. And it's amazing how fast that transition from newsstand to direct marketing went, because I know by the late 80s, early 90s, only 10 to 15% of comics of a, you know, of an issue being printed would end up newsstand versus direct.
Yeah.
So it's also interesting how the business model of the comics changed from the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. And even the 70s, and it all shifted in the 80s. We all think you go to your local comic shop now, but that really didn't happen until the early 80s.
Yeah. For new comics especially, a lot of the first comic shops were just back issues.
Yeah, and that really didn't kick into what the mid-70s.
Yeah.
Nobody really thought anything about back issues till then.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing of collecting, the idea of collecting comics is pretty recent. I think early to mid-70s.
Well, yeah, I guess you define recent as like 40 years ago.
Well.
But in the whole history of comics, yeah, about halfway through the you know, if we're going to sit there and say comics started, what do we say, late 30s, 37,
38. Yeah, you know, the superhero stuff. That's what's considered the golden age started in 37.
Okay.
So.
Well, okay. Well, yeah. Oh, okay, on that theme, what was the theme of comics prior to the superheroes in the late 30s?
Well, a lot of it was detective stories. That were influenced
detective stories, you know, satire of politics.
Yeah.
Or whatever the local comic strips were doing at the time. To get some of the, like, I mean, I was, like, for example, it's an EC horror book. But it was, like, bundled with a Joe Palooka, which I guess was boxing athletic comic, and then another crime story comic. So it seems like all the stuff, you know, prior to superheroes was, like, athletic endeavors, like boxing. I know boxing was pretty big.
Yes.
So you had some of that, maybe some, like, of the early automotive racing. And things, and then coupled with the crime noir, you know, because I guess back in the day, bootleggers were, you know, from Prohibition on and all that, were kind of romanticized. Just like criminals from that era, like Bonnie and Clyde and the other gangsters. For some reason, they were, I guess, romanticized because they were, like, sticking it to the man, and, you know, and they were put in pulps and put into comics.
Yeah, well, that's, you got to remember, that was also during the Depression, and people were dirt poor, so yeah, some of these Bonnie and Clyde became almost heroes.
Well, was it because from a Robin Hood kind of aspect?
Somewhat, although I don't think a lot of those...
They didn't give back to the poor, they just kind of kept it for themselves.
I think you probably hit it right. It's sort of like just almost like a counterculture. You know, here's, people are going through horrendous financial times, and here's these people that are sort of, they weren't just accepting the status quo, even though they're doing illegal things, or kind of, like you say, sticking it to the man, or, you know, going against the cultural standards of the day, and they just became heroes. And I think people were also like just desperate for something to believe in, whether it's illegal or
but I'm saying it's like, how is doing something to believe in?
I don't know. It's hard to explain the psychology of that era, but a lot of them weren't considered, you know. I don't know if heroes would be an outright, or at least, you know, people kind of admired or were interested in what these characters were doing.
Or maybe it was because they kind of took control of their own fate while everybody else kind of felt helpless and, you know, blown with whatever the situation was putting them in or driving them in. They didn't feel control over their lives. But here was individuals, even though it's criminal activity, they're taking control of the situation, control of their lives, and making their own path, whether it's good or bad.
Right. I think that's probably as good a speculation as any.
I don't know. I just find it fascinating and everything like that. Now, I mean, it's also the early time of radio, so now you've got radio and print. You know, print was dominant. And now they're shifting into the radio, so you had the serials. I mean, I think there were some early Batman and Superman, Green Hornet and all the others, The Shadow, everything, the serials on that. And so I guess that would also drive kids and maybe some adults, because like we're saying, you know, it really didn't get knocked down to the kid level until the 50s, but it would drive them to, hey, you know, the radio show only comes on once a week. I'm going to go get the comics, or I'm going to go get the pulp, to like continue my, you know, fascination with this character.
I don't know. It's just highly interesting period in the comics, that golden age up to the early 50s.
Yeah, and I wonder how the transition happened, because I think we're experiencing that now, going from print to digital. And you know, I think part of the problems I have with digital is, like, I mean, I like the print. Right, I like to physically have it, and what's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what is the difference between the print and the digital other than one's physical and one's electronic? I mean, what's the enticement of having something digital? What's the added dimension, the added part of it that would make me want to go to the digital for an enhanced experience? Maybe when they... comics become like, you know, VR, virtual reality, or augmented reality at that point, where you can actually be within the panel and looking at a panel in 3D. Maybe, you know, we're kind of in the midst of that right now. We haven't quite gotten into that, where, because we assume, like, you know, you kind of think back, it's like you went from print to radio to TV, and it was like an instantaneous change, but it was probably over a course of time. And it's kind of interesting, now are we in one of those transition periods from physical comics to digital comics, and, you know, they won't be the same, and we haven't realized yet what digital comics are going to do for us.
I think you're right on that. And to answer your question, at least for me, my answer to the question, what's the advantage of digital comics? First and foremost, for me, it's convenience. Because especially, like, if I'm traveling or if I'm on vacation or somewhere, you can have 500 or 1,000 or 5,000 comics right there on your tablet computer. You know, you don't have to carry your hard covers or floppies with you and take a chance on damaging them or them getting lost somewhere.
But you only care about that if they're valuable to you, and they're only valuable to you if they're a physical commodity.
That's what I'm saying, though. It's, you know, right, I don't have to, with digital, and if I'm traveling somewhere, I don't have to risk my physical commodity by taking it with me. I've got it digital.
Yeah, but you're not getting digital and physical. You're getting either or.
Well, that's true. You know, and because I'm not...
I mean, how do you collect digital comics?
Collect?
Exactly.
I don't know how to consider it collecting, not in the collect or standard, same situation, same vein as I do with physical comics.
And why is, I mean, but I don't know, for me, that part of the aspect of comics is the collectability of it also. So I wonder if, you know, given the modern, you know, market for comics, is it collectible driven? Is it story driven? Is it art? You know, from both mainstream and independent comics. So it's like, what drives the market? Why do people collect, you know, buy comics. You got TV, which gives you stuff. You've got books, novels, YouTube, comics, and all that. It's a source of entertainment. It's a source. It's a media source, and all that. So, why would people collect comics? Or, you know, I keep using collect. That's a bad word because it's I'm influencing your answer. Why do people purchase comics?
And I think there's probably a million answers to that. I mean, I don't know if you can narrow it down to one or two or even three reasons. Because you're right. I mean, it's not recently.
You're a big Batman fan. Right. Why do you get Batman stuff, whether it's digital, whether it's comics, whether it's statues, whether it's pajamas, bedspreads, onesies, whatever. Batman. Why, you know, so...
You know, I just, think part of it has to do with... It's like, I've been a Batman. You know, I'm 56 now. And I've been reading, watching, listening Batman stuff since I was, you know, 8 or 9. So I think part of it for me, it's just sort of a continuity. I don't want to say it's a way of keeping in touch with my childhood necessarily, but it's just, it's like, it's something that's always been there. It's always been an interest of mine. So I, you know, plus I just find the character completely fascinating.
The modern interpretation of him fascinating? Would you find the 50s version fascinating or the 60s version fascinating?
Yeah, all of them. If you have to keep the context of history in mind. That's where that's why I like to study the history of comic books, as well as, you know, understand what the culture was like at the time, because that helps you understand it. You can even appreciate, to me, the simple, campy stuff that was influenced by or kind of stifled by the comics code. You can still get some enjoyment out of that if you keep in mind what was going on at the time. Talked to a lot of people who think, oh my, they look and say, well, the artwork in the 30s and 40s just is not what it is today.
Well, depends on the book.
It's like, you can't just make a blanket statement like that.
I've got some early 40s Captain Marvel that's got some pretty good art in it.
Yeah. And like I say, again, you have to keep context in mind. Number one, it's like, okay, they're printing on cheap paper, which you can't get a lot of detail. We're talking about the very first four-color printing. Primary colors in black. That was it.
Yeah, and I guess to kind of convert, everybody's always said about like superheroes are wearing their underwear. Now, there was an interesting course that I took understanding that, and the reason the superhero costumes were designed the way they were was the four-color process. That's why Superman, Batman, all the characters, especially the male ones, they had their underwear there because it had to be a different color from their legs so you could show the motion and everything in a four-color universe.
Right, and that's why Batman's cape is two colors, black and blue. Because the blue, they had to have blue in there because to give it some sense of dimension.
Exactly.
Because in that four-color process, black was just black. I mean, it was just like a, you know, blob. And you couldn't tell there's no sense of depth or two-dimensional or three-dimensional of it. So they had to use other colors like blue to simulate shadows or light that's glinting off of the cape. Whereas, you know, in modern stuff, he can have a black cape and they can advance printing and color processes, give it the depth and what's needed. So, yeah, it's not needed today. So, yeah, you have to keep all that in mind when you're reading the older comics. You know, the technology of the process and...
Yeah, it was four color, and you had to do what you had to be creative into how you design characters and how you design their costumes to be able to using four colors. And it was also interesting that back, you know, in the 40s, the 50s, and even into the 60s, how the color played into, like, all the heroes had similar colors, and all the villains had similar colors. So, like, heroes would have colors like red and yellow and blue, and primary colors like that, and all your villains would be colors of like orange, green, I think yellow, and just, I don't know if it was for the contrast or what the color theory was, but you know, if you go back and you start looking at it, it's like, yeah, all the villains are similarly colored across DC, Marvel, and all that, and you see all the heroes are colored a different way. And, it, you know, we kind of like to think they weren't sophisticated back then, but no, you know, they had some thought into it and everything, and it's just fascinating because it's a little bit more sophisticated, you know, even back in the, you know, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s than we give them credit for.
Absolutely. I mean, my gosh. All you have to do is think of people like Kirby, Jack Kirby, and what some of the stuff he did. And, you know, given the limitations with, you know, the printing technology, the coloring and stuff, and you know, he was still able to... They did some pretty sophisticated stuff.
No, that was even up until the 80s, because I remember, because I was collecting then, about when they went from the newsprint to, I guess, the glossy paper or the better paper now, and artists would sit there and design or do drawings and design such that it took advantage of how the pulp newsprint would absorb inks. And, you know, the best example of that I can give is like Barry Windsor Smith. And when he did the Marvel Comics Presents, the whole Weapon X storyline, like the, you know, the origin of Wolverine from the Weapon X program, he would not sign the trade paperback because they did it on the glossy paper. And he felt the color wasn't correct because they used the same, you know, ratios or whatever of the ink. But he had designed it for pulp, which would absorb it and mix it in a certain way, and the glossy wouldn't. And so the trade paperback didn't represent exactly what he created as much as the original single issues did, because they were a different paper.
Right.
I mean, that's the thought. That's the thought that the artist and the colorist put into the comics. You know, they were drawing and all that. They took into consideration the paper and what it would do to the ink as it absorbed it and mixed it. And, you know, I think that's kind of been lost, you know, in this age now, where you do everything on a computer, it's put on glossy paper, and it's printed out exactly as you do it on a computer. It's almost made it easier.
Yeah, I think so. And I can come up with a fairly modern example of that with the Alterna comics that are coming out on newsprint. Mm-hmm. Some of the early titles, they're getting some original stuff now, but some of the early titles they put out, The Chair, Scrimshaw, couple others, were originally published as digital only comics. And I remember when I got the first copy of the first issue of Scrimshaw, and I'm reading through it, and the artwork is like, there's some panels you can't really tell what's going on, because it's almost like it just, the ink
it's a little rough,
ran together. And I was wondering about that. It's like, okay, is this because they tried too hard to keep, you know, the digital coloring, the digital process, that they're just trying to put it on newsprint, and it didn't, you know, it just didn't work as well. And I went back and looked at some of the digital panels, and yeah, they were sharper, clearer. And so, you know, it did not move to newsprint successfully. You know, some of the later issues, they seem to have corrected that, but.
Yeah, I will say how the Eterno stuff is, like, I think Scrimshaw is the one I've enjoyed the most.
It's my favorite of what's come out. I don't know, The Chair was good. It just...
No, I think I'm only up to issue 3 on Scrimshaw. Has more come out?
I think 4 is out.
Well, maybe I have to go look for it. Hey, I did hear today that Cal Exit number 2 came out.
That's what Aaron said.
And months later, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like, I look at Cal Exit or any Black Mass book as sort of like,
you know, we can't have an episode of Minnesota Rest without
Sasquatch.
You or
Sasquatch. You know, I look at it as like Sasquatch. I'll believe it when I see it.
or the sightings are rare and far in between.
Exactly. So I'm taking Aaron's word for it, but until I actually see it on the shelf, I'm not believing it. But
yeah, I guess I'll check it out later this week. I'm on the road, so I'll find my LCSs on Friday and Saturday. So,
well, you know, today's Wednesday is we're recording this, and I did not get to the LCS today.
What?
I got things going on.
I mean, that's the highlight of Wednesdays. That's the highlight of the week, is getting to Wednesday so you can go to your LCS.
Yeah, well, this Wednesday happened to be the wife's day off, and
well, okay, enough said.
Yeah, other things got prioritized ahead of the LCS. So
yeah, and then I had my issue today, you know, getting to the modern life of comics. So, like you know, between the two of us, we've been getting a lot of independent comics and everything, and it starts to get expensive after a little while. So I wanted to start kind of using a subscription service for some of the more independent stuff, like my Lion Forge and Aftershock and some other items. So I'm going to try out the Cowabunga Comics subscription service, which is kind of like DCBS, but I don't know, they seem to be a little bit more customer oriented. So this is my first attempt at using them, but my local LCS called me today and saying, "Hey, I noticed you haven't gotten any Aftershock or Lion's Forge like you usually get. Did you mean to get them or not?" So I had to call, "That's your LCS looking out for you and everything." So I called them up and I kind of told them, it's like, "Well, I'm kind of looking at getting trade paperbacks or some other ways because, you know, it's starting to get expensive getting all these books and everything." So
yeah, and I've started doing that a lot too, especially with, like, I've stopped getting the single issues of all of the Catalyst Prime stuff, so I'm going to get that in trades.
Yeah, you know, there might be one or two issues. I kind of like getting Noble monthly.
Right.
And I think there's a few others, but I think the majority of the Catalyst Prime I want to get in trades, but the Magnetic Collection stuff, like Ghost Money and Jazz Maynard, man, I'm sticking monthly with those.
Absolutely, because I want that. And I'm getting all the individuals, all the hard case stuff, because I'm ready. As soon as I read whatever issue I'm reading of whatever title, I'm ready for the next one.
Yeah, but is there any hard case coming out? I don't think there is.
There's not any new coming out in the next couple of months.
I mean, once the girl who handcuffed Houdini finishes up, I don't know if there's any.
Well, that and
I don't have any other hard case coming out.
I think the only two they've got active right now are The Girl Who Handcuffed Houdini and Quarry's War. I think they've both still got a couple of issues left to come out.
Yeah, but
I don't know of anything else on the horizon either, so yeah.
Exactly. You know what? I still have not been able to find issue 5 of Normandy Gold.
Let me write this down, because I won't look for it at my LCS, because he probably hasn't.
If he still has a copy of Normandy Gold 5, I need that.
Okay, I'll check on it.
I have not been able to find that at any of my haunts that I go to. And I got a couple of honey holes that get a bunch of stuff I can't find anywhere else, and they don't even have it.
I'll check, because my LCS guy, he gets all the hard case stuff, and he usually keeps back issues on the shelves, on the main shelves for a few months before he moves them to his filing cabinets that he's converted into.
Filing! You know, I've been to one comic shop which puts their comics in filing cabinets, and I still haven't decided if I like that or I don't like it.
Well, these aren't the standard filing cabinets.
No, I've been to one where it's standard filing cabinets, and it's like, okay, this is different. No, I've got my shop, my LCS that I actually have my subscription at, they have, I don't know, it looks like they have shelves, and then they have these wooden, I don't know, I don't know what you call it, but they put the books, they're not in short boxes or anything, they're just in these wooden, like, totes or whatever you want to call it.
I know what you're talking about. I think I've seen
some. Yeah, you know, they're pulling to that, so, you know, that works pretty good for me for there.
My pull list is getting smaller and smaller as I'm trying to economize on some things, because I was getting, for a while, really when we first started, I was pulling first issues of just about every indie thing that came out, and gosh, it gets expensive. It just gets too prohibitive cost-wise.
Okay. Independents are, I can understand, because they have fewer books. They're like creating that issue.
Right.
And it starts to add up, because there's a lot of, it's very easy to publish stuff and get stuff out there now, I think. And there's a lot of stuff. I am disappointed in myself for not getting more Scout. I need to kind of dive into more Scout comics.
I've not the few, I've read a few titles that I've liked, but I've read several that I don't like. Fish Eye didn't do it for me at all.
Yeah, but you like Heavenly Blues.
I like Heavenly Blues. Then I read sort of a horror story, Infernoct. Didn't like that. Graveland was another that came out, and the artwork did not. I could not get the artwork at all. So that one was, after one issue, it's like, no. So I think I'm like...
Hey, is Stabity Bunny coming from Scout? Or is that Amigo?
Stabity Bunny number 2 came out last week, I believe.
Oh, I think it's been more than a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Hey, yeah, Ronnie got me a Kansas City Planet Con editions of Stabby Bunny 1 and 2, so I'm going to have to pick those up from him sometime. You know, you can't go wrong, I guess, with a Stabby Bunny or a stuffed rabbit that kills for its owner. I'm assuming that's what the premise is. I don't know. What else would Stabby Bunny be?
I haven't read it, so I'm not going to speculate, and I don't remember what the solicit. There's some things that are finished in Scout that I want to read. I think they put out a title called Hinch Girl. If I'm not.
That sounds familiar. You sure it wasn't Fantagraphics?
No.
Oh, gotta go it. And I guess you're going to edit out the silence.
Yeah, oh yeah. I will compress. The books, the issues, the individual floppies are published by Scout. But then they did the first trade paperback. Yeah, Dark Horse. That's who it is. So
Dark Horse.
Yeah. The first trade collection of Hinch Girl, which was published by Scout, is published by Dark Horse. Explain that. I can't.
Okay. I guess. I don't know. I remember back in the day how I used to like pick up novel paperbacks as I'd go into the bookstore and I'd look at the covers. Do you have a comic there where you're just sitting there and they've got them out there and you see a cover and it's like, hey, I'm going to pick that up and try it out.
Oh, yeah.
Or flip through it or something.
Oh, yes. I've done that quite a number of times. The cover or flip through and the artwork looks interesting or...
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and I'm surprised that more people don't. I kind of like to watch people, what they're getting when I go to the LCS to see, especially like what they're getting of indie comics. And it's shocking to me the number of people that will go in. And I'll watch them come in, and they'll go through the, especially on the new comics for the week rack, which is, you know, the whole back wall of this comic shop that I go to.
Yeah.
And they'll go in, and I'll pick up such and such a DC book, such and such a DC book, Marvel, DC, Marvel. And that's it. And they'll just walk right out. And it's like they never even look at what else is there. And then there's some people that come in, and I watch, and they just, he'll grow in, and he'll grab 5 or 6 Image books. It's like,
mm-hmm.
As if Image. And, you know, I've known people, I know one person in particular, personally, that all he reads is Valiant. He won't even look at another publisher.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's convinced.
I mean, he's experienced other stuff.
I know, but this guy is convinced that Valiant is the only publisher that's producing anything of quality. And I'm like, think about that. The only one that's producing anything of quality. It can't possibly be, but yeah, there's too much stuff out there. I've recently bought, you know, I've been buying a lot of hardcover books. Some of them.
Yeah, I see you've gotten the eBay bug of just buying hardcover books.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of DC's books, but I've been getting.
Is it affordable in DC on eBay to get hardcovers?
Sometimes. It just depends. You find deals on it. Just kind of look around till you find one. Some of them are not reasonable at all. Or the person that puts it on there will do something really asinine, like, oh, here's the book. You know, and they're going to sell the book for, say it's a $25 hardcover book list. And they'll have it for $15. And then you look down there and then $12 shipping. No. It's like, no, I'm not going to pay 80% of the cost of a book, which, you know, in shipping or something like that. Or they'll, you know, and it'll say expedited shipping. I don't want expedited shipping. I'm not in that much of a hurry. Send it to me book post and let, or I'm not interested. So yeah, you can find some jewels. Ronnie and I have been, we haven't done so much here recently, but for a while, Ronnie and I were sending each other links to eBay 5 or 6, 7 times a day. Hey, look at this. Look at this book. And he would like, God damn,
were they, this stuff. Were they the outrageous prices or actually good prices?
They were good prices. A lot of stuff. I mean, I've got
better deals than you get in used bookstores.
Sometimes.
I've been in some used books. I've been in the used bookstores, and there's a couple I go to, and they're hardcovers or even trade paperbacks for comics. They're still about cover price.
Yeah. No, I've found quite a few things that are less than cover. And a lot of times I'll find it with a really good price, really good shipping, you know, $2, $3, or sometimes even free shipping.
Oh, media mail.
In fact, I contacted a seller. He had 4 books I wanted in his store, his eBay store. And I contacted him. I said, do you combine shipping? We made a deal. He said, if you buy those 4 books, shipping will be free. No, nothing. No. You can contact the sellers and work deals. A lot of times somebody will make a listing and they'll put a price on there, but they list it with the option of make an offer.
Oh, yeah. I love making an offer, but it's always like I'll offer 10% less than what they're offering, and they'll come back like a dollar less than what the original thing was. So and then it's like, then I get pissed off and I like, screw you.
I haven't had that. I've been fairly fortunate most of the time when I make an offer, and I don't try to lowball the people.
Yeah, you don't sit there and outrageously lowball, but I'll sit there, you know, if it's been on there for a while and nobody's looking at it or watching it, I'll do 10%.
Yeah. I don't have a hard and fast rule, but I'll look at it. Okay, I'll say, all right, say somebody's listed a book for $20, $25, but they've got $8 in shipping. I'll offer them, say, all right, take $4 off. In other words, cut your shipping in half down to what I would consider a reasonable shipping. And I'll make an offer like that. And they usually take it.
Mm. No, I'll sit there and it's like somebody's got a book for like $30 and I'll offer 26, you know, 10% or whatever, $4. And they'll come back and go, $29.50.
Yeah, I've had that happen a couple of times. And when it does, I'm out.
Yeah,
it's like, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, play hardball with you all day long. And it's like, either accept my offer or I'll go somewhere else.
Cause I'm not I mean, that's why you got it on there, you know, or best offer.
But no, I mean, you know, you find deals where you find them. Sometimes you get better ones in a used bookstore. Sometimes you can find it on eBay. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you can find new stuff that's discounted on Amazon for, and you can get it, especially if you're on an Amazon Prime member, which pretty much everything is free shipping. You can look and find stuff that, hey, here's this is with the free shipping, I can buy this new for cheaper than what I found on eBay for a used copy. So it's, you just have to look around and hunt around until you find something. But I've got a number of indie books here recently, hardcover books. Several by Daniel Clowes.
Mm-hmm.
That I haven't read that I need to get to pretty soon. I'm hoping to spend some time. A couple by Gilbert Hernandez that are not Love and Rockets books, but they're by the guy who, one of the,
well, they've done stuff other than Love and Rockets?
Oh, yeah. Gilbert more so than Jaime. Jaime has pretty much stayed with this his story, but Gilbert, he's a little more prolific than Jaime is, and he's collaborated, well, like Assassinistas. That's a good example. That's coming out from...
Oh, yeah.
He's doing the artwork.
They can't draw. Yeah, where they can't draw or look into a scope properly.
Yes, that's correct. So he's done the collaboration, but he's also done stuff in Gilbert's universe, Love and Rockets universe. He has a character who is a B-movie star. Her name is Fritz. His Palomar stories about the city of Palomar in Mexico. And in there, from time to time, she will refer to some movie that she'll give the title of some movie that she starred in. And he came out and wrote books of those movies. In other words, it tells the story of those B movies. So they're standalone. They're not tied in with the story of Love and Rockets. And they're actually pretty good introductions. If you want to read something by Gilbert Hernandez and you don't want to take the time to delve really deeply into Love and Rockets, you can get one of those Fritz movie books, or, you know, he's done some other things that are separate. So there are other options, especially for Gilbert. You can't find so much for Jaime. He hasn't done that much separate from Love and Rockets itself.
There you go. I don't know. Have we talked much independent comics today? We've kind of gone on into history of stuff and into things and everything like that. So I guess we've kind of diverged from our regular scheduled programming tonight.
No, we've had independent comics here and there. We'll talk a little bit about Scout and...
I guess in the grand scheme of things, all comics are independent at one time. You just had two players kind of come dominant, after the 60s and everything, and they're not considered independent, but they were independent back in the day.
Exactly. Yeah, we can justify anything we want to talk about.
Exactly. It's our podcast. Nobody can tell us what to do.
Yes.
Not even the pod father.
Yes, but I think he would be proud of us, because we're the kind of format we took tonight is sort of what they do on Nerdy Legion, sort of just go in whatever direction we want to go. So.
Yes, the comfy couch. We don't quite have the comfy couch. We have the, I don't know, slightly comfortable recliner. You know, leaning up against the tree. Out in.
Barely upholstered ottoman. That's what we have.
Oh, there you go.
So.
I don't know. Maybe we ought to have Nick on here sometime and talk about, like, he's probably had some independent stuff he's read and everything like that. I don't think we've had Nick on here.
No, and I think we probably should, because he's one of our, I mean, as far as... What comments we get.
He's
on
one of the ones
Twitter.
That like poke us with this. Oh yeah, the Twitter stuff. I still gotta figure out the Twitter machine. Maybe that's the old man in me, just can't figure out the Twitter, or I just don't have the right application.
You really need to start out with, do you have TweetDeck?
Nope. All I got is the Twitter app. And I go in there and I see stuff and it's kind of, I gotta scroll through stuff and it's eh.
I might need to give you tutor you on using TweetDeck, because it.
No, maybe we do that at C2E2.
Yeah, you can't. It's platform. I mean, it's PC. You can't get it on your phone.
That's what I was about to say. Because most of the day I'm on my phone or my iPad or something like that. So it sounds like Twitter needs to fix their experience.
I don't know. It's still better than Facebook, but that doesn't say a whole lot. Facebook's got one of the worst designed interfaces.
I don't know about it's worse designed or if it's the worst algorithmic.
I don't know. It frustrates the hell out of me every time I try to, and I'm pretty much off of it. I go out there maybe once a month.
Oh, I go out there to be entertained by the insane nonsense out there.
Well, see, that's what I got away from, because that stuff was driving me crazy.
Oh, you just gotta approach it with the right attitude. Well, plus, I've gotten some great deals on some Facebook comic auctions.
Well, that's interesting.
I've gotten some good deals out of the Facebook stuff. There, I had a guy that I linked through and all that, and now whenever he finds any of the Valiant Nintendo stuff, he hits me up first for it, so I get first dibs on anything he finds. Now, am I paying a bit more than if I was finding it in the wild? Yes. But he's doing all the work, so how much is that work worth to me? And he found me some early Valiant Nintendo stuff that is like, it is like some mint stuff.
I was on a Facebook page of collectors, people selling, and I never found anything much that I was all that interested in.
Oh, I don't know. I think you introduced me to that group, and I was in there, and I hopped on one night, and they were doing an auction. Now, I actually picked up a... I can't remember what issue it was, but it was an issue of, was it Detective or Batman? I think it was Batman, and it's that Neil Adams cover that's the homage to the early Batman Ghost of Gotha's Castle, The one where it's got Batman in the background, oh, yeah, behind the castle, and the moon and all that, and you've got the guy with the hounds chasing the girl and all. I mean, it's a classic cover.
We were looking at that just the other night.
Yeah, I know. I got that. I got a CGC 7.0 graded cover of that off of a Facebook live auction.
Wow.
At a deal. Because that's the nice thing. You'll find the people on Facebook that are auctioning off comics, and they'll have 20 or 30, like, viewers. And you can get some deals on there. I mean, if they're trustworthy and all that, you can get some good. I've had some good success with the Facebook auctions on some stuff.
I'll have to give it another look, because
it's scattershot, and I'm not going to say everyone's going to hit you, but once you know, it's like anything else. Once you get through there and you cultivate, you know who puts good stuff out there, who's trustworthy and things like that. You can find some deals out there. And you don't, it's not like you got like 1,000 people looking at it and going to snipe you at the last second like they do on eBay. Because they got the software out there that'll like snipe at the last second to kind of get stuff and everything. No, I've gotten some great deals off the Facebook live auctions. You know, you take it with a grain of salt, though. I mean, there's probably going to be some bad players out there, and don't risk anything more than what you're going, you know, what you're willing to lose. But yeah, that whatever that issue of Batman is, which escapes me right now, maybe I need to look it up. I'm completely happy with it. It's a CGC graded copy. I pay what the market value is, and it's better than the copy I had in my collection. So I have a unslabbed copy of my collection now that's a lower grade, but it'd be great for somebody that I have that I probably need to get rid of. I think it was a group you showed me to, because yeah, that was when I was lamenting the fact that it's like, you know, I've got, you know, I like to get books and all that, but stuff I got like 5 or 6 years ago where I enjoyed a series, but I want to keep it in the PC. You know, what do I do with it? You know, I've got a full run of Irredeemable and a full run of Incorruptible, which I enjoyed the books and everything like that, but now it's kind of like they're in there to take up space. I'm not going to reread them, so what do I do with them? So do I throw them on that Facebook group or whatever? So
I'm trying to think. I can't remember the exact name of it, but I know which one you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, and that issue of Batman is Batman 227.
227, okay.
Oh, that's just an awesome cover.
No, I know, and it's one of Martin's favorites, too.
You know, it's one of the early Neil Adams, so if you ask him to autograph it, it only costs you like $200 for him to autograph it.
Yeah, and Ronnie at Planet Comic-Con, he was kept threatening to say he was going to go up, harass Neil Adams prices for a signature. So,
yeah, I went to a Wizard World in St. Louis once, and he was there, and it was like, I forget what the price was, and I was just like, no. Yeah, that's just way too much.
Yeah, I can't think of anybody's signature that I would pay $200 for. Anyone's.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Yeah, I just paid $100 to get an autographed photo of Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Collins on the same photograph. So the Apollo 11 mission. Yeah. I paid $100 for their three autographs. Okay, so I know Neil Adams isn't worth more than that.
No.
So what, we need to wrap this thing up tonight?
I think
we rambled on enough?
I do want to say that this episode of Best of the Rest was made possible by Audible. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks, and they've got a catalog of over 200,000 titles.
200,000 titles?
200,000 titles, yes. And if you visit the website nerdylegion.com/audible, you can sign up for a trial subscription. I think it's a 30-day trial subscription, and get a free audiobook.
Oh, so what free audiobook would you get?
You're putting me on the spot here. I don't know. I mean,
I was listening to 2BD, and you know, I'd be very tempted to get Ready Player One.
I've got that one. I haven't listened to it yet. I've been using Audible for years, and I'm really pleased with them. Right now, I'm listening to Logan's Run. I don't know if you ever remember.
Oh, how does Logan's Run do in an audio?
It's pretty good. It's a pretty good book.
Who's narrating?
I think can't remember the name of the person. But,
yeah, I think Will Wheaton is the one that does Ready Player One.
That's pretty cool.
I think, but I'm not sure. I could be mixing it up with something else I heard on there. But yeah, I eventually want to get to the point where I can sit there and listen to audiobooks. You know, I can't currently my current job and everything and my lifestyle and all that. But yeah, I think Audible's kind of great. And go to NeuroLegion.com and sign up for it.
Yeah,
try it out. Get at least one book, see if you like it or not. It's like, you don't think you like, well, if you like podcasts, I think you're going to like audiobooks.
And you can get a lot of books that are comic book related. I have listened to, well, that book I mentioned earlier, The 10-Cent Plague.
Mm-hmm.
It's available from Audible. Marvel, The Untold Story is another one I've listened to there.
Oh, hey, I need to get on there and see if I can find some old, I'm a big lover of science fiction from the 50s and the 60s. I'm a big Asimov fan and Arthur C. Clarke.
I know they've been some of that out.
And probably listen to some of that in audio. I mean, I've read the Foundation series, I don't know how many times, but to probably listen to that would probably just be a whole new perspective on things.
Mm-hmm. And, if you have trouble sleeping, and you want something to put you to sleep, you can download and listen to Dune.
Oh, come now. Dune is not that bad.
Oh, I thought that was flatulent. It just went on and on and on.
So you've never finished it?
Then? I have finished it. I finished the first one. I didn't read any others. But I finished it. But it's like, oh, my God, this thing is...
It gets better after the first book. I enjoyed the series.
It's not the storyline. It's just the way he wrote was so verbose and I thought overly wordy.
Oh, the details of the description?
Yeah. He would take a page and a half to describe something that you could have done in a single paragraph. And I just thought, it wasn't the best.
But just think of how that translates to the spoken word.
I might give it another chance in an audiobook sometime, but. And I didn't read it till late. I was probably into my 30s before I ever read it. So I didn't. It's not one of those things I read as a teenager.
Oh, I remember it specifically when I started reading Dune. I started reading Dune when I was 29 years old on a flight from Hartford, Connecticut to... I think I was going down to Atlanta. I had gotten the book and started reading it on that flight. Well, exactly. So, but it was like everybody else has read it, so I guess I ought to read it too. So, yeah, I liked it. And over the course of the next 15 years, I think I made it through all the novels. But it took me 15 years. So I don't know if that's
how many are there? I can't remember.
Well, you have the three or four books. I can't remember they're written by Herbert. And then I think the two books to finish the primary storyline was written by his son and another author. So it depends on how you want to combine them all. So like any franchise or any book series, once the author died, the publishers decided, hey, let's add some people on there and continue to grab some money from it somehow. But for the Dune series, I actually enjoyed the extensions to it. It had some twists and some turns to it.
Right.
But you know what? I bet you can get all, whether they're written by the original author or a son, on Audible. But you know what? If you don't like Dune, then I would highly recommend the Asimov series.
The Foundation trilogy.
You got the Foundation trilogy. You got the Robot trilogy. Well, it's even more than a trilogy. You got the Robot novels. You got the Galactic Empire novels. Then you get into the Foundation novels. And... it's a beautiful thing. I can't speak highly enough of Asimov. I love Asimov.
Yeah,
but I'm highly biased.
He was very prescient on a lot of stuff. Things like, fingerprint recognition or somehow it recognizes a person's DNA.
Well, it seems like a lot of these science fiction authors from the 50s and the 60s were able to do that. I don't know if the authors now can or not, but, you know, Asimov, Clark, Heinlein, they just all seem to predict some stuff and kind of look. Science is first and writer second. So maybe that had something to do with it. But you know what? Maybe we ought to have a podcast on like 50s, 60s, 70s science fiction.
I'm liking that.
Are you liking it? We'll have to talk to the podcast father, podfather about that, and maybe get something out there. Maybe we get some like people to kind of like comment on whether or not they like to hear something like, you know, science fiction from that era and all that. So, you know, even, you know, just so this, you know, hit us up at the Twitter machine. I'm at UTENGR on the Twitter machine, even though I'm trying to still figure out Twitter, you know, Jay's at
Jay Forgets.
You know, maybe we need to branch out and we kind of need to do some science fiction from the early days and all that. Not that we don't like science fiction from now, but there's something about that 50s and that 60s and that 70s science fiction where everything was atomic or everything was nuclear. And it's just kind of like clean, fun science fiction.
I like it. I think we need to, start talking this up.
All right. So the Twitter machine is where it's at. And if it's a Twitter machine, it's Jay.
Or you can get us at BOTR Comics. That's it.
Now we've been all over the place tonight.
Yeah, this has been the craziest thing we've ever done. But I enjoyed it. I think it works.
Yeah, you know, there we go. We're kind of like branching out. We're not going to be confined by what we set out this podcast to be however many months ago it was. You know what? And as the whiskey flows, so does the conversation.
Yep. Although I'm stone cold sober tonight, but
don't worry about it. I've drank enough whiskey for the both of us.
Well, that's good.
So, with that, we're gonna bid you a fond farewell and good night.
Good night, everyone.